Welcome to the Online Marketing Rockstars podcast. We have an American guest today on the show, Sean Ellis of growthhackers.com. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thanks, Philip.
What is growthhackers.com?
So Growth Hackers started initially as kind of a place for myself. You know, I wanted a place where I could hang out with other marketers that shared my interest. And I, at the time, didn't really have sites that I thought I could do that at. And so I built it as a community where you share content and discuss content. And over time, it's evolved into some other things. So we do AMAs. It's probably a lot like some of the things that you guys are doing. So AMAs.
I think it's a fascinating place. And I read a lot of articles or stuff that I can find there. And it's a place for the growth hacking community.
Yeah, exactly. And we have some original content, but it's really a lot more Q&A and just engagement and discussions about other people's content. And it's fun.
Is it true that you also came up with the term growth hacking first? Is that like your idea?
Yeah, it is. It's for better or worse. Some people hate it and some people love it. So yeah.
And when did you invent it? I mean, what was the...
It was a time when I had basically started doing these six-month kind of traction roles where I help new companies come to market. I'd previously spent 10 years working at two companies long term, and I realized I liked the upfront part. So I was working with these companies in the early days and getting like some stock in the company. And so I was really aligned to help them be successful. So I wanted to put somebody into each company to take over when I left. And when I advertised the role as a marketing role, just the people who I was getting were kind of more of your traditional textbook type marketers, and they really didn't seem to know how you grow an online business. And so I started looking around to how I was approaching it, how Facebook was approaching it, how some of these really fast growing companies were approaching growth. And it just seemed to be different than how a lot of people were defining marketing. And so that's where I said it needs a different name and just came up with a different name. And it took off from there.
Before we get into how to do growth hacking these days, maybe you can give some context and where do you come from? I mean, how did you start? Are you a developer? Are you a classic marketer? What are you by background and how did your journey into this whole industry start?
Yeah, so I started just in marketing and actually in the early beginning, I started in sales, which turned out, so I basically, I graduated from college in 1994, so a couple of years in sales, and then in 96, I switched to marketing. So literally just at the start of kind of the internet push on things, and it turned out that I think a sales background was almost better than a traditional marketing background, because in sales, you manage a funnel. You know, I do 100 phone calls and maybe get 10 meetings, and those 10 meetings lead to 2 sales, and you're used to kind of really working the numbers. And so when I moved to online marketing, I didn't have a marketing background, but my sales background, I think, helped quite a bit. And so, I went in and originally I was working for this company called Uproar.com, had invested all my money in it in 1995, and decided that I was going to try to help this business that I'd invested in. And so they sent me to New York and to basically sell advertising. And there was almost no people on the product. And so I'm going and to these big Madison Avenue advertising agencies, and we have maybe 100 people using the product, and they weren't interested. So I complained to the CEO, and he said, "Well, why don't you take a shot at trying to grow the business?" And I kind of never looked back from there. I ended up really liking it. And that site ended up becoming the number 7 website in the world in terms of total usage time. It was called Uproar.com.
And what did you do at the time to push it forward?
You know, originally I just, I went out and just bought some kind of search engine advertising. And it was funny because I spent a lot of money, and my CEO said, "This is great. It worked." And I think I spent $20,000 because that was the minimum buy that the search engines allowed at that time. And maybe we doubled or tripled our users. But I did the math and I was like, I just can't see how that advertising will pay for itself. And so I got kind of nervous about it, even though he was excited about it. Just I think part of it is because I invest my own money in it. At least I kind of had the rational lens. I didn't care if I was getting a pat on the back of praise. I wanted to make sure that I was actually keeping the business in business. And so I realized I didn't need to spend $20,000 to see if something worked or not. So I could spend $500 and see if it worked. And then if it worked, I could do more. So that was the first thing that I did, is I figured out how to get very minimal buys across a bunch of different sites. And then because we started the company, I lived in Budapest, Hungary at the time when the company started. And so I was the only person not in Budapest. They sent me to New York. And so one of our big advantages was low-cost development in Budapest at the time. Now it's not so cheap, but back in the mid-90s, it was a big advantage when we were competing against some of these other game companies. And so it's all about how can we leverage this low-cost development. And one of the first things that I did was just convince them that we should have really good tracking. So they built tracking to a level where for every dollar I was spending, I could see exactly how many advertisements we generated across our games.
Was that cookie-based tracking, or was that?
No, it was basically it was a UTM parameter that was written then into the database for the user, like once they had registered. So we could then see how many ads did that user have. So they couldn't play the games without signing up for the games.
Okay.
And so, it sounds kind of normal today. Everybody does that. But in 1997, it was a huge advantage for us to be able to spend money on these little $500 buys, get out of them if they weren't generating. And we didn't always know exactly what our return on investment was, because it depended how much we were selling the ads for. But I could at least know that a dollar spent here generated twice as much usage time as a dollar spent here. And so I could just shift a lot of that money. So that, I think that helped us get good traction in the game space. And then ultimately what really broke us out was it was probably like kind of our first real growth hacking was we built games that could be embedded on other websites. So sort of the same way that YouTube's strategy a few years later, we really invented this embeddable widget at the time that people would just put a little JavaScript on their site. We got it onto 40,000 websites, and including like CNN and like big sports sites, and all of these sites were sending traffic back. So you'd start the gameplay experience on these other sites, and then you would join a game with thousands of people on our site and engagement along the way. And that helped us really become the number one game site, but competing against Microsoft, Yahoo, Sony. Sony was the number one advertiser on the entire internet, and we were able to beat them. Not only were they number one on the internet, they also had all of their television game show formats where they were promoting their online games, and our more creative approach helped us eventually pass them and then beat them. So that was pretty exciting. That was.
And then you, like, along the journey after that, your journey went.
That business reached $1 billion valuation. We listed on NASDAQ and then ended up selling it to Vivendi Universal. Same group of guys who started that company then started LogMeIn in Budapest. So I had moved back to Budapest. We started LogMeIn, and then spent the next few years building LogMeIn. And today that's about a $5 billion company. And so I ran marketing there from customer zero through the IPO filing.
Wow. And then you also went to, a couple other really big household names, PayPal, Dropbox.
Not PayPal, but Dropbox, Eventbrite, Lookout. So yeah, some other good names. But basically what I realized after LogMeIn was that the stage that I liked the most and where I thought I could offer the most value was actually in the first year. The problem is, at least in Silicon Valley, that the stock options take 4 years to vest. And so if you're successful, it takes 4 years to get paid for your work. And so not very many people get a lot of practice at the stage that matters most, where you're kind of figuring out the trajectory of growth in the business. And so I wanted to get a lot of practice at that stage. And because I had two IPOs that I'd already had in my two previous roles, I had the opportunity and kind of leverage to negotiate that I would only stay for 6 months. My stock would all be vested, and then I would move on. And so,
and yeah. How did you help like a Dropbox? What did you do for them?
I started the day or the week that it launched publicly, and basically built it to the first couple million people. And we did just in that 6 month period.
So you worked directly with the founders and everything?
Yeah. So there was eight people there when I was there, and the our goal going in was to make the culture data driven, test driven culture. And a lot of what I was focused on was just this playbook of what I saw work at LogMeIn, which was if you, like most marketers, just focus on bringing them to the front door and of a website. You know, maybe they do some testing on landing pages, but it's nearly impossible to build a big business that way. That you need to bring them all the way into experiencing the value of the product, and so. Basically, you need to then first you have to make sure that there is value in the product. If there's no value,
it's difficult.
Then it's very difficult. So that was the first thing that I did even before I joined companies. I would actually take some of the early users on the product, make sure there was value, and then I would start to build backwards from the customers that love the product, and then work my way out to the channel. So when did they first? What do they love about the product? What was their first experience where they discovered that? And then kind of what was the reason they wanted to try it. And so essentially building a path to that great experience in the product and lots of testing to maximize how to get people there. And when I did that at each company, that was a huge part of accelerating growth.
And where did the first customers then come from that used Dropbox? Where did you find them?
So
where did you acquire them?
I was fortunate that during the private beta, they had gotten it to where there was a couple hundred thousand people who had signed up for it during
for the private beta, and they just spread it to
so that was through even before they launched the private beta. They were really creative and good. So I think a lot of my role with Dropbox was to help the founders understand that marketing isn't as complicated as most marketers try to make it out to be, that they could be really good at it, and they already had been really good at it. So they had created a video that went kind of viral about how this product was going to work, and had some pretty funny stuff in it, and then had worked to get that video distribution on Dig at the time, kind of the Reddit before Reddit was around, and got it really popular on Dig, and that got enough people interested who tried the product. And that's kind of a prerequisite for me, is it's really hard if no one's tried the product to know if there's any potential for growing it. But what I could see in that early group of users was that they truly loved the product. And so that was kind of the starting point of just understanding them and then building the machine around those people to get a lot more people in there.
And when you say building the machine around those people, what is the machine? I mean, what do you do?
There was a couple things. So one of the challenges that we had at LogMeIn was that when we got to 100 million devices on the product, like that had the software on there, it was really hard to find a channel that could make an impact, a new channel that could make an impact and grow the business faster. So size kind of became our enemy over time. Like our growth rate just through math naturally would shrink. So what I was looking, I joined Dropbox 6 months after I left LogMeIn. And what I was looking for at Dropbox was, how can I build a growth engine that that was leveraging the existing users on the product? So when we had 1 million users, our growth engine would be 10 times more powerful than when we had 100,000 users. And so there was already some natural pieces there. So anytime someone shared a file, that was kind of an advertisement for the product, right? Anytime someone invited someone else to a folder, that was even more of an advertisement, because it not only introduced them to the product, but
it required them to use the product.
Yeah, but not only acquired them to use the product, but anytime they added new content to that folder, it re-engaged them. They would get a notification that new content has been added to your Dropbox folder. And so it got this really good retention loop in there. But interestingly, I think the biggest driver of growth during the 6 months when I was there was the just pure natural word of mouth. People who love the product and just told their friends about it.
But that's good for them, but really hard to replicate, right?
Well, that's the thing is you can replicate it.
Okay, how?
That's where I think a lot of marketers fall short is that no one's going to spread the word if they respond to an advertisement, hit a page, and never use the product. And so I think that's the first part is making sure that they actually get in and use the product. And that was my challenge when I was at LogMeIn is originally I approached it the way most marketers approached it, where it's the product team's problem to get them from, now I brought them to the door, got them to sign up, you get them to use the product. The product team just wasn't good at that.
So marketing and the product wasn't connected. And you're saying what it definitely is required to build a great web product is marketing and product have to be like one unit.
Yeah, word of mouth is based on someone actually having value from the product, having a great valuable interaction or experience with the product. And so I think that was what unlocked all the growth at LogMeIn. Originally, I could not spend more than $10,000 a month, and we were growing pretty slowly. And it was because of this inefficient funnel. And so just to show the power of this, I went and showed the data to my CEO and said, 90% of the people who sign up for the product never use it. So there's not going to be any word of mouth if they don't use the product. They're not going to spread the word because they signed up for it. And so they never use that. And there was just a lot of complexity in installing the software, going to a different computer, remote controlling your computer. There was a lot of steps to getting value from the product. But when I showed this to him, he, to his credit, said, we need to fix this. We need to make this the most important thing that the product team is doing. And he literally took every single developer and product person and said, they're going to focus on that first customer experience. They're going to focus on, we're going to basically go through every step in that funnel, do lots of testing, lots of research, surveying, find out why are you signing up, not installing the software. And so once we did all of that, we were able to get almost 1,000% improvement on the number of people who used the product. And as soon as we did that, it meant if they didn't use, they weren't going to buy. So it meant that our return on investment on the spend went way up, but it also meant that our organic word of mouth went up by 10x. And so with no new creativity on the marketing side, no new channels tested, the same marketing that scaled to $10,000 a month now scaled to $1 million a month. And so that's really the same process I went through with Dropbox was to take every single person that showed interest and remove as much friction as possible from the customer acquisition funnel to actually get them to experience the product, keep them motivated moving down the funnel and remove friction along the way. And that's how you unlock word of mouth.
So it's a misconception that in growth hacking, the value is created by knowing like underpriced media values by finding like users for cheap. That's not the key. The key is to have a product that spreads or the product that is valuable and spreads.
Yeah, no, I think the key is to understand all of your levers of growth and that customer acquisition, external facing customer acquisition is just one lever, but they're all interdependent. If I can figure out a channel, if I can figure out a referral channel that gets each of my users to bring someone else in, that's really powerful as a customer acquisition lever, but it also means that my paid marketing is going to work twice as well. If each person is telling another person, and if I also, and really I think the biggest thing that growth hackers do that's effective. So most growth teams actually come out of the product organization and not the marketing organization, which is pretty interesting. And
do you have a can you code? Do you have a developing background?
I don't, but that's where I built my second hire at LogMeIn was a developer on my team. Uh-huh. So it's really more like a Ocean's 11 type kind of team of skills that are coming together, designers, marketers, copywriters, developers, and managing experimentation across all of the levers. So
is it common for like a Silicon Valley type startup these days that is B2C model or B2B model, whatever, to have like a growth hacking team or that kind of a team?
Yep. That's the biggest commonality that I found. It really started with Dropbox and Facebook in 2008. LinkedIn started about the same year, but Airbnb, Pinterest, all of these multi-billion-dollar companies really aren't spending much on advertising. They've got these teams that are basically rapidly experimenting on each of the levers of growth. So figuring out how to retain people twice as well is probably more important than figuring out a new channel, because it's got leverage where it makes every channel work twice as well. So it's really experimenting all the way through the customer value creation process.
And across all platforms. I mean, I assume it's different with every platform, but
yeah.
I mean, there's probably like some levers that are always important. I imagine notifications in an app is
right.
always, or like an email marketing or like a customer relationship management. Can you like point out some levers that you find important across different platforms that always pop up and that always like have to be managed correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, as people have become more data oriented, a lot of times they forget about the qualitative side. So they forget about actually why do people like the product. And so it's the combination of those two things that applies in every business. If someone's going to keep using the product, if they're going to even use it once, they have these motivations. So it's understanding kind of what's driving there. The tactics are going to be somewhat different with every business, but you're going to have kind of the same high level collection of growth opportunities. So retention as an opportunity, every business, if you can't retain users, you can't grow your user base. You just replace the same set of users each time. So retention is the same. Notifications can be an important part of driving retention in some businesses. In other businesses, notifications aren't going to work. I think in my mind that before notifications, like notifications are a tactic, but before notifications, the best driver of retention is a great user experience. And a great user experience is not just based on like, is it a great product? It's also based on, do you do a good job of delivering people to the right user experience in the product? And that is what a growth team is focused on, is actually, you know, hiding some of the complexity and some of the features and knowing that people who absolutely love the product use it this way, get this benefit. So they're setting the right expectation and ultimately have that goal of getting them to what growth hackers call an aha moment with the product, which is like a great example is Facebook's 10 friends in 7 days. If they could get a new user, 10 friends in 7 days, that user was much more likely long-term to stick around on the solution. So once you find that type of data that suggests that that's what you need to get people to, now the marketing team or the growth team, whatever you want to call it, has something to really focus on. And so that it's about not just getting them in the door, but thinking about how do I get them to get those 10 friends quickly. So that's where, and LinkedIn has something similar. So that's where inventing ways to be able to find out which of your friends are already on the platform. So just scraping your address book, but giving permission to like, here's, you know, would you like to go through your address book and see who's already using this so you can connect with them is a great way. It creates friends on both sides, just added another friend, which led to more engagement. And I think most traditional marketers aren't thinking about that as part of the value creation process and in how you actually grow the user base, where that's a huge part of growth. In fact, I would say more important than just bringing a new person in the door who doesn't end up sticking around because they don't get to the right experience with the product.
Do you observe what like the platform that are hot and coming these days, and Uber and Netflix maybe, what they do? I mean, do you watch out and you sort of like analyze what they do just for fun, or just because you can't help it because you just live and you watch it and you say, oh, whoa, that's smart.
So what that's one of the things that we do with growthhackers.com is that we write these studies. That's the great thing with all of this is that you can't market in secret. As much as you may want to keep it a secret, it's all public touch points. And so we've analyzed all of the public touch points, plus all of the interviews with people. Sometimes we even talk to other people. So for Uber, we wrote a very long growth study on exactly how Uber is growing.
And in short, what was it like the one or two key levers?
The most important thing is, according to the head of growth at Uber, is actually defining what their success metric is. And for them, everything is optimized on increasing rides in the system. So it sounds kind of basic, but if you think about, most marketers would optimize on how many new app installs can I get, or how many new drivers can I get. But ultimately, that doesn't create value in the system. Value is what keeps people sticking around. So what creates value for Uber is rides taken. So once that's value for both a driver and for a rider. So everything they do is optimized on maximizing the number of rides taken. And then there's other things like how did they roll out market to market, knowing that if they just kind of went across the whole world at once, it would be a lot harder to get traction. So that's some of the really creative stuff.
So it sounds so easy, but the key is it's the right KPI, to find the right KPI.
Yeah, and what the head of growth at Uber said, I was at an event there not too long ago, and he was formerly at Facebook, and he said that the commonality between Facebook and Uber that he credits the most important thing is a single metric, what they call a North Star metric, that everybody is defining growth in that North Star metric as a reflection of value in the business. And that's sustainable growth versus some kind of metric that's not representing value to the users.
Okay.
And then everything from there is correlation. So what are the levers that have the most impact in accelerating that North Star metric? So in most businesses, what I find is that the activation lever is the most important one. So if you can't give that first-time user the right experience, then they never become a second-time user. And so that's where most marketers fall short, again, is that we it's not because we don't know we're supposed to. I think all of us intuitively know that we would like to go deeper in the product and get people deeper in the product, but as marketers, we don't have access to run experiments very deep in the funnel. That's product and engineering. And so we do what we can, which is just bring them to the front door. But what that means is that we have much lower allowable acquisition costs because of all this inefficiency that's happening in the steps that are beyond our control. And so I think that was really the big breakthrough that Facebook made, which is they built a team that was cross-functional that managed all of those levers. And what you're seeing now at Uber, they recently changed. You're seeing this pattern happening in a lot of companies. They recently changed where the head of growth is now also the head of product, because product is really your biggest lever for driving growth in the business. And so this guy who I was referring to is their VP of product and growth. And you're seeing that at a number of companies.
What other company that are you like closely observing, or could you talk about, like, as an observer, what's going on?
I got a note today from the head of growth at Airbnb, because I was really curious how they I'd never come across any information on how they were setting up their growth team. And Uber's pretty famous for basically having two teams. One's focused on riders and one's focused on drivers. And so that's how they're maximizing rides taken, is as many riders into the system, as many drivers into the system as they can. And then product is driving engagement on that. But I'd never seen how Airbnb was organized, but their head of growth today told me that they're organized in a pretty similar way, that they have brand that doesn't focus on guests or hosts, but then they've got basically performance marketing teams and other teams that are focused just on increasing the number of hosts in the system and another team that's focused on increasing the number of guests in the system.
And how, I mean, we're talking about marketplaces here, like purely digital companies with very low, like heavy assets, if you want to call it that way. But let's maybe touch on a company that's, for instance, the Casper mattresses. It's a completely different product. I mean, you have to like get somebody a mattress and then he has to like it. And it's really difficult to find out if you like the product because you can't use it like an Airbnb or like a game or like Uber, like in the first minutes and for like a couple of euros and maybe nothing. You find out if you like the product or not.
So
how is it different with the Casper or with an e-commerce company of a different type?
Yeah, at least Casper is direct to consumer. So at least you have that opportunity to manage the full customer life cycle. Again, it's knowing it, you can get the feedback loop. So you can still ultimately ask them if they're still using it. You can have a very flexible return policy, which a lot of these guys are doing in the mattress space, especially. I think historically an e-commerce company might say you can't return, but they want you to be able to return so that they get that feedback loop if the customer has received this experience that they actually want to stay on there. And then knowing that getting the customer to a great experience where they want to stay, when they want to keep using the product, that's what unlocks a lot of the word of mouth. And so basically being able to that value focus, I think, is a huge thing. But interestingly, I think that the more challenging than the e-commerce would be those companies like L'Oreal, where they mostly don't have access, or Unilever, where they don't have access kind of to the end user. I think that's why Unilever acquired Dollar Shave Club, because Dollar Shave Club was really good. So like, for example, if I tried to cancel my Dollar Shave Club subscription, they make it very easy to pause my subscription. It's a lot harder to cancel it. So they kind of keep me in that system. And then when I ultimately did cancel, they asked me why I was canceling. And I said, the quality of the shave just isn't good enough. And they said, why don't you try our executive razor? We'll let you have it for free for a period of time. And so it at least got me, you know, that it's managing customer retention is a huge part of those businesses as well. So I think that's why Unilever acquired them, for that kind of end-to-end kind of customer creation and value creation process. But interestingly, L'Oreal was just in the United States about a month ago, and they had all of their country managers for a week in Los Angeles and San Francisco, with the main topic being growth hacking and how can they apply that in their business. And so I spent a night with them, and it's a lot harder, I'll admit, but I think I think that the opportunities. It's, you know, for online marketers, most of us are pretty data driven, and I think there's some good pieces. So for us, it's kind of going from a four in terms of like potential to try to get to a 10, you know, a 10 out of 10 to be doing it right. I think for a L'Oreal or for a lot of these older companies, that they're not using the data feedback loop very well, even on the customer acquisition side. So I think they can still take a lot of these principles and get better at the parts of the business that, like, they can apply it.
How would they do that? I mean, just give us a little hint. I mean, they're selling the stuff to a supermarket, and then it's sold like up without their control. How do they get the feedback loop going?
So they can apply it to the channel, for example. They can essentially find out from the, but so one, they can actually launch a separate brand that is an end-to-end brand, and you're seeing some companies do that. But even you know, it sounds kind of weird, but the same way that there's rider and driver growth at Uber, you could have channel and customer growth. And so, at least on the channel side, trying to work with the channel to get deeper into that feedback loop, but ultimately knowing that the channel is happy with your product is, you know, part of how you retain that channel. As I explained to them when I met with them, though, is that my expertise is in startups and is in this process, and I've increasingly done it in bigger digital companies. it's what I said to them is it's important for you guys to try to understand this and see where it applies in the business. But I'm certainly not an expert in applying it at L'Oreal, so okay. or any business like that. But I think what you're seeing is more and more companies that are bit. So Walmart, for example, acquired a company, set up Walmart Labs, basically to be the growth team for Walmart, and they're building some interesting apps for feedback. So we talk about it in our book. Hacking Growth that's coming out next month. And the case study on that is around an app that they created where customers can do price matching, where they take a picture of their receipt and then basically Walmart is able to give them a better deal if they can find it. And so that's sort of the benefit for the customer in taking the picture. But they also, the customer acquisition team then at Walmart is now using that data to inform how they bid on keywords. When they're competitive on the price, they're going to be more aggressive. When they're not as competitive, they're not going to be as aggressive. So I think it's about trying to tie as many pieces of the customer experience to inform the activities that others are doing. So like, for example, being able to find what drives retention in the business, communicate that information back to the acquisition efforts so that you're acquiring people on a promise that reflects why they ultimately end up sticking around. Like the more that the information kind of flows across that full customer experience and the data flows, everybody starts making smarter, better decisions. And it should ultimately be based on decisions that lead more new people to a great experience with the product.
Okay. So the product is your marketing.
Ultimately, value is you can't grow if you can't retain. Retention is a function of great customer value. The product is what drives a lot of that great customer value. And so an integrated end-to-end process of taking someone from consideration mode to actually getting value becomes a huge advantage in driving growth in a business. And I think for most companies, it requires some type of reorganization because that value creation process sits in different silos in the organization. Especially the bigger the company is, the more likely that these silos don't communicate very well together. And that's I think the big breakthrough that these growth teams have had is that they're cross-functional. They sit across silos and ultimately are based on that customer value creation process.
Whoa. Okay. Any other startups? I mean, I really like the Casper example where you just explained to me why they are so liberal and so open with the return policies, where they say 100 days return policy is not a problem because they actually want to invite the customers to use the product.
And it also helps them fix the parts of the system that are causing the customer to not want the product instead of the old traditional direct marketing approach of we got the sucker to buy it, let's move on. Like now they realize that so much of the growth is not just getting them to buy it once, but getting them to buy it lots of times and getting at every company that I've been a part of that has been successful. Ultimately, organic word of mouth is by far the most powerful growth channel in the business. And that is completely a function of having a great experience with the product. And that I think is kind of the key is that you have to have this end-to-end integrated approach to maximize the number of people who have a great experience with the product.
Okay. Okay. And any other startup example like the Casper one that we can learn from that you observe these days somewhere in the market where you find a company product, I mean, like the tactics so interesting or so that you could share?
I think there's just a lot of good stuff coming out of a ton of different companies. It's really, and again, the tactics. I think that the tactics are the last stage. Once you identify where is your customer value creation part broken, like where are you losing people in the conversion funnel, what's the opportunity? I mean, and you can take that all the way out to the channel. So you know that a lot of your customers spend time on Pinterest and you're not doing anything in Pinterest, then that's a missed opportunity. And so you should focus some energy and resources and testing there. But I think it's basically that another piece that we haven't talked about is that a lot of this comes down to a weekly growth meeting that looks a lot like what an agile software development team does, where it's basically executing the scientific process, where it's, you know, you're taking your analytics to identify the opportunity. You're generating ideas with clear hypotheses of how they will affect that opportunity, and then you're prioritizing which of those ideas get implemented. You're trying to run as many tests in a week, but you know, have like a set target of tests of maybe 4 or 5 tests per week that you're running, and then you've got a team that actually implements those tests or different people that are implementing those tests. You're running the analysis, and it's through that testing that you get smarter about what's working. And it's, I think it's that rhythm that these growth teams have where they're every week meeting to process the new learning from last week's test, decide what are the tests of this week, and just this continuous motion where, in my experience with marketing teams, it's kind of a little bit more continuous. There's not that sort of gathering where it's a super systematic process of testing and learning.
Okay. Whoa. That's really interesting, and it really, really made a lot of things clear to me that I observed and that I didn't see exactly and didn't see through exactly. Now I see through them a lot better because I know that, like, your thinking and the thinking that you bring to to the industry. I mean, you seem to me like you're one of the guys that multiply the story into different companies, different startups. And I see the fruits and the results, but sometimes I don't see the thinking. Now I see a little clearer.
I think one of the big advantages that I had is that when a company becomes really big, with online marketing, we've got that feedback loop where we can actually see if it's working or not. But you imagine like a big beer company, for example. They run millions of dollars of advertising. Which advertisement caused that person to go in the convenience store and actually buy that product? It's like the bigger they get, the harder it is to figure out what's exactly working. The benefit that I had was taking so many companies in that very early stage where it's literally like nothing happening and being able to experiment with things where I could see the impact because there's just not as much noise and start to really figure out what matters and in which order. So clearly, total waste of time to focus on growth if you have no retention because you have no value in the product. So that's like the first thing is validating product market fit, and then doing all of these high leverage activities ultimately is how you unlock the channels to work for you. Because if you are better at converting and monetizing, then you're going to be able to outcompete people in the channels, whether it's being sold on a CPM or on a bidding basis for CPC, whatever it is, your ability to outbid the competition is based on your ability to take someone and effectively convert them into money. And that conversion to money, so much of it happens outside of the control of a marketing team normally, that's to me the key to being able to effectively compete in channels.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I find really interesting. I mean, I know the German marketing quite a bit. There's not that many people that think like you do. And I think it's really like bringing value to our German marketing industry, online marketing industry, at least.
There's some groups in Berlin that are doing pretty good. Like SoundCloud, I think, does it pretty well. Some of the rocket internet companies, I think, have.
But are they like product focused in the way that you would want them to be product focused? I mean, Zalando is, but I mean, what company do you see in Germany outside of SoundCloud that does that correctly? That is really strong in that.
So I mean, interestingly, like Rocket Internet, the Samwar brothers behind that were investors in Eventbrite. So I had a little interaction with them back like almost 10 years ago now, and they seem to really know it and understand it. And I think that's why they've been so successful, is that so much of this, having a systematic process of bringing businesses to market and expand. It's not to say that they can't improve a lot, but I can tell you that some of the SoundCloud team I've learned a lot from. And so
SoundCloud to me is a company that is definitely product focused, right?
Sure.
But my observation was that many of the rocket companies, and some of them are struggling these days. Mm-hmm. It might be because they're really good at doing the performance marketing, the customer acquisition, but the product focus is not as strong.
Yeah. Maybe they're not going as deeply with it that I thought they were, because, you know, again,
I mean, they're really strong in SEO and knowing where to acquire traffic. That's they're winning every battle there. But I think
that's really my big thesis, is that no longer is enough, because everybody's getting very good at using data to uncover channels that work. And as a result, those channels get saturated so quickly now and stop working in such short period of time that unless you're really good at end-to-end value creation, you're going to lose in the channels. And so we may be seeing that with them, that they may not have that part as well as I thought they did.
I mean, that's I think like a Dropbox or SoundCloud, Airbnb, they're really like product folks. They're really strong engineering, I think, and they really like manage the product well and the user retention. And I think the retention part is what they are better at, and the acquisition part is what German companies are really good at. That's my current gut feeling.
Yeah, and the next most successful German companies are going to be the ones who figure out how to drive retention as effectively as they drive marketing. And I think the best news is that the process for doing that is the exact same as the process for uncovering channels. It's very test and data driven. You're just applying that process in a place where product teams are not used to doing it. So you got to use that kind of marketing approach, but do it much deeper in the funnel in product.
Whoa. Okay. Thank you very much. Whoever wants to follow, I mean, I'm pretty sure we have a couple thousand listeners every week. Many of them want to like go and find you on the web, growthhackers.com.
Yep.
You have
I'm active on Twitter at Sean Ellis.
You have a book coming out?
Got my book coming out, Hacking Growth. I'm not sure it's coming out in Germany yet. So we have
Amazon will do the job.
But we've got a Dutch version coming out. But I'm assuming that
do you have a German publisher yet?
Not yet. So if there's a German publisher out there, jump on it, because we've got a couple in China, Japan. We got like all over the world, but not Germany yet. So I'm sure there will be a German one coming up.
Okay. And you're speaking tomorrow at our Online Marketing Rockstars conference. But by the time people listen to the podcast, that's probably going to be over. And only a few lucky ones, only a couple thousand lucky ones will have heard you. So
I have a lot of my presentations on YouTube as well. So
and maybe there, if you like it here, and I'm sure people like your stuff, maybe you're coming back one day and people can see you again in Germany. Do you speak in Germany? Is that very rarely?
I was here in October in Berlin for a small workshop. But I have not. This will be my first on stage presentation.
Perfect. Yeah. Premiering tomorrow on Friday. Thank you very much for coming by, and enjoy Online Marketing Rockstars.
All right. Thank you.